Thank you all for coming. Today we're going to study the first 16 verses of Exodus chapter 13. So if you'll turn with me in your Bibles, please, to Exodus 13, we will read these verses together before we begin our comments. Exodus chapter 13. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Sanctify or consecrate to me every firstborn, the first offspring of every womb among the sons of Israel, both of man and beast. He belongs to me." Moses said to the people, "Remember this day in which you went out from Egypt, from the house of slavery. For by a mighty hand the Lord brought you out from this place. And nothing leavened shall be eaten. On this day in the month of Aviv, you're about to go forth. It shall be when the Lord brings you to the land of the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite, which he swore to your fathers to give to you, a land flowing with milk and honey, that you shall observe this rite in this month. For 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread, and on the seventh day there shall be a feast unto the Lord. Unleavened bread shall be eaten throughout the 7 days, and nothing leavened shall be seen among you, nor shall leaven be seen among you in all of your borders. You shall tell your son on that day, saying, 'It's because of what the Lord did for me when I came out of Egypt.' And it shall serve as a sign to you on your hand and as a reminder on your forehead, that the law of the Lord may be in your mouth. For with a powerful hand the Lord brought you out of Egypt. Therefore you shall keep this ordinance at its appointed time from year to year. Now it shall come about when the Lord brings you to the land of the Canaanite, as he swore to you and to your fathers, and he gives it to you, that you shall devote to the Lord the first offspring of every womb, and the first offspring of every beast that you own. The males belong to the Lord. But every first offspring of a donkey you shall redeem with a lamb. But if you do not redeem it, then you shall break its neck. And every firstborn of man among the sons, your sons, you shall redeem. And it shall be when your son asks you in times to come, saying, 'What is this?' Then you shall say to him, 'With a mighty hand the Lord brought us out of Egypt, from the house of slavery.' And it came about when Pharaoh was stubborn about letting us go that the Lord killed every firstborn in the land of Egypt, both the firstborn of man and the firstborn of beast. Therefore, I sacrifice to the Lord the males, the first offspring of every womb, but every firstborn of my sons I redeem. So it shall serve as a sign on your hand and as phylacteries on your forehead. For with a mighty hand the Lord brought us out of Egypt." The 13th chapter of Exodus continues the theme of the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which you may find today. I may refer to that as the extended Passover if I happen to say that. I'm simply referring to the ordinance of Passover itself and the extended Passover, which is known as the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which extended for another 7 days. So it continues this theme, and then it introduces regulations pertaining to the firstborn, both human beings in Israel, sons, and animals. The chapter also will detail, verses 17 through 22, the departure from Egypt. In terms of its structural organization, it's a little bit odd when you first look at this, because the first two verses of the chapter form a divine oracle in which God speaks to Moses, and he introduces this oracle with a formula that we should be pretty familiar with by now. It's the formula, "Then Yahweh spoke to Moses, saying." Immediately following this, there is an introduction of one of the main topics of the chapter. It's given in verse 2, where God says to Moses, "Sanctify or consecrate to me every firstborn male. The first offspring of every womb among the Israelites belongs to me, whether man or animal." That's the first time this has really been presented to us this way, and we would expect that in verse 3, Moses would launch into explanation about the regulations pertaining to what we will call the law of the firstborn. But that's not what happens. Instead, he begins in that first section, section 1 being verses 3 through 10, to revisit another theme that's very familiar to us by now, and it's the theme of the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. It's not until we get down to verses 11 through 16 that Moses returns to this concept, this idea of the firstborn, and the obligations that Israel's required to perform with regard to the instructions God gave to Moses. Then the chapter concludes with details about the departure from Egypt, the route that the Israelites followed, and God's protection of his people by the pillars of cloud and fire. Two things catch our attention regarding the way this chapter is organized. First is that the law of the firstborn is introduced in verse 2 at the very beginning of the chapter. Many times a subject's significance is weighted by how and where the Bible brings that subject to our attention. This doesn't mean that the other topics in the chapter or section aren't important, but there's special importance attached to being mentioned first in a divine revelation. So that's the first thing. The law of the firstborn is mentioned first. The second thing that catches our eye is that the law of the firstborn and the Feast of Unleavened Bread are somewhat intertwined in this chapter. The regulations regarding how Israel is to observe this extended Passover are given in verses 3 through 10 between the first mention of the law of the firstborn and then the extrapolation of the responsibilities under that law, which follow in verses 11 through 16. I think this indicates that the two must be related theologically. We spent a lot of time over the last few weeks talking about the Passover. I always worry a little bit when I look at the section that I'm responsible to teach for the next week, and I say, oh, that's something that we've talked about for the last 19 weeks. People are going to say, well, you know, we've heard this before. Why do you keep bringing up this topic of the Passover? Haven't we already covered that? Well, we have, but the Bible keeps bringing it up in different contexts, which means that it's got to be important in our understanding of this chapter. So, you know, who am I to decide when we spend enough time on something that the Bible continues to bring to the forefront? So we're going to continue to look at the Passover in the context of this chapter. And my responsibility will be to try to sort out the particular significance of the mention of the Passover here in this passage and its relationship to the law of the firstborn. So here's the approach I'd like to take. I want to look at that first section, verses 3 through 10, that discuss the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And then we'll take a look at section 2, which is verses 11 through 16. I'll also be mentioning verse 2 again in that second section. That's the part that deals with the law of the firstborn. Afterwards, I'm going to do my best to explain the relationship between the two sections and the reason that the chapter is laid out like it is. So, section 1, verses 3 through 10, the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. One of the keys to interpreting, I think, both sections, both the section on the Passover and the section on the firstborn, is found in verse 3. There is where God tells Moses to tell the Israelites, remember this day. Remember this day because it's a very important day. It's the day the Lord brought you out of Egypt from the house of slavery. Already back in chapter 12, verse 14, God has told the people that when he brings them out in the Exodus, that that day will become for Israel a memorial day, a day to be remembered by all the Israelites in every generation. Israel must remember that it was not by her own strength, not by her numbers, certainly not by her ingenuity that she gained her freedom. Israel's freedom was due to one thing only, the mighty hand of Yahweh. Keep that in mind as we go through the two sections we're going to study today. Verse 3 contains what we're going to call the Exodus formula. The Exodus formula is this: for by a mighty hand the Lord brought you out from this place. That's the Exodus formula. I've even written it up here for you. For by a mighty hand Yahweh brought you out from this place. We're going to see this formula here in verse 3. We'll see it again in verse 9. We'll see it again in verse 14. This is the reason Israel is walking out of Egypt to inherit a land that God's going to give them. It's because the Lord Himself made this thing to happen. In verses 4 through 8, Israel's setting out on a journey that marks a new beginning for this nation. At the end of this journey will be Israel's new homeland. And when the people arrive there, this nation of slaves will have put off the yoke of bondage. No longer will they obey cruel slave drivers and perform hard labor. Instead, the new nation will perform a very pleasant service under the yoke of the Lord. A yoke Jesus would describe in Matthew 11 as a yoke that is easy and a burden that is light. This new yoke, if you want to think of it this way, will be a yoke in the service of the Lord, not in the service of Pharaoh, and it will include the observance of the Passover feast. This life of hard labor that they've known for hundreds of years will become a time of celebration. The feast of Passover is celebratory, and it gives the Jewish father, the head of the family, the opportunity to teach future generations about Yahweh, who brought them out of the land of Egypt and out of slavery by a mighty hand. It will include the eating of unleavened bread. And that eating of unleavened bread, which is out of the ordinary, is going to cause the sons and the daughters to ask a question. They're going to say, "Why are we eating unleavened bread? Explain this to us, if you will." Casuto puts it like this: you're commanded not only to remember, but to remind. To remember that God brought you out by a mighty hand, and to remind your children what God has done. In this reminding, in this answer that the father gives to the children, verse 8 strikes me as being particularly significant. It's a verse that says, "And you shall tell your son on that day, saying," assuming you're answering the question, "it is because of what the Lord did for me when I came out of Egypt." This is the answer to the question, why this? This is what the Lord did for me when He brought me out of Egypt. This is one of those times when we should notice not only what the text says, but what the text does not say. The text does not say it's because of what the Lord did for us when we came out of Egypt. Each father, even the fathers who were not alive at the time of the Exodus, even those fathers are to say, they're to teach this story of the Exodus in very personal terms. They're to say, "We're doing this tonight because of what the Lord did for me when I came out of Egypt." How is it possible that fathers in future days who did not come out of Egypt with Moses will be able to say what the Lord did for me when I came out of Egypt? They can say it because through this ordinance of Passover, the Exodus of their fathers becomes not just a rehashing and a rehearsal of an ancient story, but it becomes this father's experience in the present. It is his coming out relived through the ordinance of Passover. This is because what God did for that first generation of Jews when He brought them out of Egypt, He did for all of Israel, for every father in every age. This is the practical application of the theology of the Exodus transcending the event itself. This is the practical application of the theology of the Exodus transcending the event itself. It's the personal application of Israel's historical theology, a theology that is grounded in redemptive history. It is the personal application of that theology to every believing Jew in every age. The theme of Israel's historical theology becoming the personal salvation story of the individual Jew is carried on in verse 9. Now, I'm going to suggest a slight change in the translation of verse 9. It doesn't really change the translation of the words, but it changes the focus. It's going to make the focus of the verse that thing which Yahweh did for Israel. Here's how I would structure it. And this thing, this Passover, shall be to you for a sign on your hand and a remembrance between your eyes that with a mighty hand Yahweh has brought you out of Egypt. So that when you understand this, then the law of the Lord may be in your mouth. What Yahweh did, this Exodus formula, is primary to the faith of Israel. The result of God's mighty act, His initiative, is that the law of the Lord will be in your mouth. This means that the Exodus and all that encompassed the deliverance of Israel, the plagues, the Exodus event itself, the deliverance, the Red Sea, these are all meant to become personal in the collective memory of every Jew. And the sign, the remembrance, that's to keep this memory fresh in the spiritual life of Israel is the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Now, over the centuries, this clear precept gave way to the use of something called phylacteries, which were little leather pouches. And what the Jews would do is they would wear these patches on their left arm and around on a band around their forehead. And inside this little leather pouch were written verses from the Scripture, from Deuteronomy 6, the great Shema of Israel, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one Lord." Certain sections here from Exodus chapter 13, and they would take literally what God said here in chapter 13, and they would wear these things on their bodies. Phylacteries brought the rebuke of Jesus in Matthew 23 as outward signs of self-righteousness. They do all their deeds to be noticed by men, Jesus said, for they broaden their phylacteries and they lengthen their tassels. The reason for mentioning the hand in this verse is to remind the Jews of Yahweh's mighty hand by which He brought them out of the land of Egypt and out of bondage. The clear intent of mentioning the forehead, which is literally between the eyes in Hebrew, was to remind the Jews to remember, that is to keep in their minds what God had done for them. This brings us to section 2, which is verses 11 through 16. This is the continuation of the law of the firstborn. Let me just remind you, let's look back at verse 2. This divine oracle begins with a command by God to Moses in verse 2 that says, "Sanctify or consecrate to me every firstborn, the first offspring of every womb among the sons of Israel, both of man and beast. He belongs to me." And then skipping to verse 11 and 12, actually. Verse 11, "Now it shall come about when the Lord brings you to the land of the Canaanite, as He swore to you and to your fathers, and He gives it to you, that you shall devote to the Lord the first offspring of every womb and the first offspring of every beast that you own. The males belong to the Lord." By the words, "Now when the Lord brings you into the land of Canaan, as He swore to your fathers." Think about that sentence for a moment. We see there a link. It's a link back to the Abrahamic covenant, which He swore to your fathers. And it's a link forward to the conquest of the land of Canaan, which was a fundamental aspect of that covenant. So we have here in this sentence a theological continuity that extends historically to the past and eschatologically to the future. Verses 11 through 16 detail what was stated in general principle in verse 2. In verse 2, the term that's translated sanctify or consecrate there is the Hebrew word kadosh. In its most basic form, kadosh means the realm of the sacred, as opposed to the common or the profane. In the form in which it's written in this verse, it refers to the act by which that distinction is effected. The language may even be clearer in Ugaritic, which is probably a Semitic language most closely associated with biblical Hebrew, where it simply means to be holy. In verse 12, a verse that more or less parallels verse 2, there's a different term used. It's the term avar. It's translated set apart in the King James. It's translated devote in the NASB. And perhaps the best translation is the NIV's give over. Avar literally means to give over or to pass over. This term has the connotation of transferring ownership. This is important to understanding the law of the firstborn. When he says in verse 11 that you shall give over, he's talking about the transfer of ownership. In the case of the firstborn, the Israelite was to transfer ownership from his possession to the Lord's possession. Probably the best example in the Old Testament of the meaning of this word in a different context is found over in Numbers chapter 27, where we read, if a man dies and has no son, then you shall transfer his inheritance to his daughter. So it means to transfer possession. This law applied both to animals that were owned by the family, and it applied to the firstborn male child. Several times in this section, there's a reference to the womb. These references to the womb imply that this is the firstborn male child of each wife, if indeed a man had more than one wife. Let me just sum this up. The Lord considers the firstborn males of the Israelites' animals and even their firstborn sons to be a holy possession that should be set apart and transferred in terms of ownership to the Lord. In the ancient Near East, originally this idea of passing over, giving over, originally meant to offer as a sacrifice. So you can see, with regard to his sons, the Jewish father has a problem, unless there's a mechanism by which a son can be redeemed. Now, redemption, by the very nature of the word itself, means to purchase for a price. Redeeming and passing over, in the sense of the change of ownership, are related concepts. So very early in Israel's history, it was established that God has the right to the firstborn son of every Israelite family. Likely, this was a tradition that was already fairly well known in the time of the patriarchs. And what Moses' words do here in Exodus chapter 13 is they formalize this practice for Israel and bring it under the law. Now, I mentioned earlier that in the ancient Near East and the surrounding cultures, originally this passing over of ownership meant to sacrifice. Many people have speculated about Abraham and how he could have considered, even for a moment, to sacrifice his son Isaac, even at the command of his God. But understanding the principle that we've just discussed casts light on the Genesis 22 story. When Abraham considered God's command to sacrifice Isaac, he did so from the point of view that God already owned Isaac. And since Isaac was Abraham's firstborn by Sarah, from his point of view, God had every right to him. Now, for a moment, let's consider the law of the firstborn with respect to animals. In the Bible, some animals are clean animals, while others are considered unclean animals. I'm really not interested here in which animals fell into which category, but rather the fact that the categories themselves existed. So we have clean animals, we have unclean animals. Here is how the application of the law of the firstborn applies. The firstborn male of a clean animal was to be sacrificed to the Lord on an altar. So in the case of clean animals, the old tradition of passing over ownership through sacrifice continued. However, the firstborn of unclean animals cannot be sacrificed to the Lord and therefore must be killed. This law establishes a means by which these unclean animals could be saved from death. The unclean animal could be saved from death by redeeming it. Redeeming it by substitution. A clean animal could be sacrificed in the place of an unclean animal. Let's consider the example of the donkey. That's the one that's used here. Now, a practical note. In this time, a donkey was worth about 10 times the value of a lamb in monetary terms. So a person who donkey gives birth to the first male donkey has a monetary reason not to kill that donkey. And yet under the law, he's required to do so unless he redeems it. So he had to make a choice. He could redeem the donkey, in which case a clean animal, a lamb, could be sacrificed in the place of the donkey with the result that the lamb would die so the donkey could live. Or, if no substitutionary sacrifice were made, then the law required him to break the neck of the donkey so that the donkey dies. Of course, in the case of the man's son, there was no such option. The Israelite was required to redeem his firstborn son. Now, it's pretty obvious if you are a student of the Bible that with respect to the clean animal that is used to redeem the unclean animal, there's a theological type pointing forward to the person and work of Christ and his sacrificial death on the cross. What may not be quite as clear is that there are two theological types associated with the donkey. The death of the unclean animal that's not redeemed through the substitution of a lamb points to the judgment that awaits every man who does not accept the redemption that God has provided through substitutionary atonement, the clean for the unclean. The salvation that results for the donkey from the sacrifice of the clean for the unclean depicts the deliverance the believer has who accepts God's substitutionary provision, that is the death of Christ, as his personal sacrifice and his personal substitute. I hate to tell you this, but when we consider where mankind fits into this picture, and by mankind, that's a nice way of saying you and me, we're the donkeys. So whatever the story is that this law is telling the Israelites with respect to unclean animals, we need to understand that it's a story that the Bible is teaching us about ourselves. Once again, we're told that this very graphic application of the law of the firstborn will elicit questions from the children, especially from the firstborn son, wouldn't you think? When that son asks you, "What does this mean?" you're to answer, "With a mighty hand, the Lord brought us out of Egypt from the house of bondage," the Exodus formula. And as part of that answer, the father is to recount for the son the events surrounding the Exodus, including the hardening of Pharaoh's heart that led to the 10th plague and the death of the firstborn of the Egyptians. Now, several things should stand out to us when we read this story. The first thing is during the Passover night in Egypt, if we go back to that night, when the destroyer took the lives of the firstborn of those not protected by the blood, it's apparent that the Jewish boys were just as subject to the penalty of death as the Egyptian boys. The second thing that we realize is that it was the blood and the blood alone that protected these boys from the same judgment we see in the case of this donkey, if it were not redeemed by the blood of a lamb. So it was not the ethnicity of the Jew that saved him. It was substitutionary atonement. Now, this story would have been a very personal story to every firstborn son in Israel. When our daughter was about 14, she asked us one night some questions about abortion. It's a natural thing for her to do. It's been a controversial subject in our society for decades, and kids were talking about it at school. Her questions gave us the opportunity to explain to her our position on the subject. But it wasn't what Mom and Dad had believed and what we told her that made an impact on her. It was a story she had never heard, and a story you may find hard to imagine. When we moved to Ann Arbor, where I was a student at the University of Michigan, we had one child, a son 4 months old. When our son was 5 months old, I received some shocking news from my wife. She probably was pregnant. Now, this wasn't part of the graduate school plan I had worked hard to devise. It was way out of in left field. A little later, our suspicion that we were having another child was confirmed at the University of Michigan Health Center. Here's how the conversation went that day. Them. Well, Linda, you're expecting. Can I set you an appointment to speak with one of our abortion counselors? Us. What? Them. Literally. Well, you'll want to get rid of this one, since you already have a child who's 5 months old. Us. No, I don't think that'll be necessary. So much for the student health service. We left. We made an appointment with another doctor in Ann Arbor. Here's how the conversation went. I recommend that we abort the fetus as soon as possible so you can get back to your lives as students at the University of Michigan. We left. We went to a third doctor. The conversation began exactly the same way. But at least this doctor agreed to deliver the child if we were foolish enough to carry it to term. It would be hard to explain the look of horror that came over the face of our daughter when she realized that she was that unborn child, and that had it not been for her parents refusing the advice of three medical professionals, she would have been killed before having a chance to live. Her position on abortion today is fundamentally grounded in these experiences and the story that we told her that night. For our daughter, the topic of abortion suddenly moved from the realm of the theoretical to the realm of the very personal very quickly. This is an example how a story from the past, even a past that predates the life of the child asking the question, can become very personal and real for that child. The law of the firstborn in Israel made the same impact on the firstborn son of every Jewish family as the father answered his question, "Why do we do this?" I couldn't think of a better example to make that point. In verse 16, we again read about phylacteries. They're in view again. The real question here is whether the Lord ever intended for the Jews to wear a physical sign on their bodies or whether this was meant to be metaphorical. I'm pretty certain the intent was symbolic. In the same sense as Jeremiah's word, "I will put my law in their minds and write it on their hearts. I'll be their God and they will be my people." So we've talked about the Passover. We've talked about the law of the firstborn. We've seen that they are entwined in the chapter. We've seen that both the Passover and the law of the firstborn elicit questions from the new generation that the father is responsible to answer. So how does all this fit together? What's the relationship between the Passover and Feast of Unleavened Bread to the law of the firstborn? Well, the first thing that we notice is that there's a striking parallelism between section 1 and section 2, between the section that deals with the Passover and unleavened bread with the section that deals with the firstborn. If you look at this, they both have to do with the entrance into the promised land. Listen at verse 5 from section 1. It shall be when the Lord brings you to the land of the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite, which he swore to your fathers, a land flowing with milk and honey, that you shall observe this rite, that is Passover, in this month. Listen to verses 11 and 12, section 2. Now it shall come about when the Lord brings you to the land of the Canaanite, as he swore to your fathers, and he will give it to you, that you shall devote to the Lord the offspring, the first offspring of every womb. The first offspring belongs to the Lord. Very much a parallelism there. Both focus on the father's answers to the son's questions. Verse 8 from section 1. You shall tell your son on that day, saying, it is because of what the Lord did for me when I came out of Egypt. Look at verse 14 from section 2. And it shall be when your son asks you in times to come, saying, why are we doing this? Then you shall say to him, with a powerful hand the Lord brought us out of Egypt from the house of slavery. Third, both require a sign of remembrance on the hand and the head. The first part of verse 9 reads, and it shall serve as a sign on your hand, it being the Passover, and as a reminder on your forehead, that the law of the Lord may be in your mouth. Verse 16, so it shall serve as a sign on your hand and as phylacteries on your forehead. And both are grounded in the Exodus formula. With a mighty hand the Lord brought you out of Egypt. 9, the end of verse 9, for with a powerful hand the Lord brought you out of Egypt. And in verse 16, for with a powerful hand the Lord brought you out of Egypt. Both sections are patterned the same. Further, both sects seem to have a single focus, and that single focus is the answers that the father gives his son in answer to the question, what is the meaning of these things? Therefore, both the Passover and the law of the firstborn must be related to the transmission of the faith of Israel from generation to generation. And I think this is the key to understanding this entire section, verses 1 through 16. Notice a few things. That the father's answer is more than a recitation of Jewish history. The son is to internalize these facts of history as a personal faith, as a personal experience. What God did in the history of Israel is to live in the hearts and the minds of every generation of Jews. Israel's history is to be in his mouth, it says in verse 9, and written on his hand as a remembrance. Both ceremonies, the ceremony of the Passover and the ceremony of the redeeming of the firstborn, are linked to the Exodus formula. For with a mighty hand God brought us out of Egypt. As early as chapter 4, verse 22, Yahweh declared through Moses, Israel is my firstborn. Israel. All of Israel. God has proclaimed his right, his ownership, to all of Israel. And in Exodus 6, 6, he has promised, I will redeem my firstborn son. As early as 6, 6. The fact that Moses is the oracle of this divine communication, that the divine revelation is given by God on the very day of the Exodus, anchors God's claim to Israel in the fundamental redemptive event of Israel's faith, the Exodus. When we understand it in this way, this preamble, this divine introduction, verses 1 and 2, apply equally well to both sections. I hope you're beginning to understand the significance of something that I said last week, that Israel's history and Israel's theology, Israel's faith, cannot be understood separately. They must be considered together. They must be considered together because the events through which God appropriates his claim on his people, the Exodus itself, the protection of his people by the pillars of cloud and fire, the deliverance at the Red Sea, these are all facts of history. But they were internalized by each generation of Jews as the ground for personal faith in the God of Israel. It's the same for New Testament faith. Now, we do the same thing when we look at the even greater redemptive event to which the Passover points, Calvary. New Testament Christianity is no less history-based than Israel's religion. Francis Schaeffer, in his book, The God Who Is There, makes this point. He says, if you had been present on the day of the crucifixion, you could have touched the cross in the sense that you might have gotten a splinter in your finger from it. This is not to be trite. It's to say that this event took place in history. And yet it is an event that we internalize 2,000 years later as the basis for our personal faith, in exactly the same way that Israel's redemptive theology is grounded in her own real history. What does it mean to internalize redemptive history? Theology as an end unto itself is nothing more than an intellectual exercise. It's no different from taking a philosophy course. For theology to impact a man in the way God intends it to do, something must take place beyond cognitive reasoning. When Dr. Honer explains the passage in Ephesians that says, "For by grace are you saved through faith, and that not of yourselves, it's the gift of God," he describes grace as the objective cause or basis of salvation, whereas faith is the subjective means by which a man is saved. In other words, there must be an objective body of truth that forms the basis for faith. And then there must be a subjective response, an internalizing, if you will, a subjective response to it that involves both the mind and the will. Here's the objective history. Christ died for the sins of the world on a cross that one could have touched on a hill outside of Jerusalem in 33 AD. Perhaps the best example we have in Scripture of how we internalize or make this fact of history into our own personal faith is found in the 20th chapter of John. And we'll close with the reading of this Scripture. Verse 26. After 8 days, his disciples were again inside. Thomas was with them. Jesus came, the doors having been shut, and he stood in their midst, and he said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Reach here with your finger. See my hands. Reach here your hand and put it into my side. And do not be unbelieving, but believing." Thomas answered, and he said to him, "My Lord and my God." Jesus said to him, "Because you have seen me, have you believed? Blessed are they who did not see and yet have believed. Therefore, many other signs Jesus also performed in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these have been written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and believing you may have life through his name." There's a great continuity in Scripture that extends from the book of Genesis through the book of Revelation. It contains a lot of stories and a lot of facts. But what makes this significant is when this redemptive history, this thing that God has actually done in the world, becomes the basis for your personal faith and mine.